I think there might be something real in the original Disneyland. There may be some power there, although twisted and hard to access. But some parts of Florida are filled with real magic. You just have to keep your eyes open. Ah, for the mermaids of Wikiwachi. Follow me, this way. Everywhere was the sound of music. Jangling, awkward music, ever so slightly off the beat and out of time. Wednesday took a $5 bill and put it into a change machine, receiving a handful of brass-colored metal coins in return. He tossed one to Shadow, who caught it, and realizing that a small boy was watching him, held it up between forefinger and thumb and vanished it. The small boy ran over to his mother, who was inspecting one of the ubiquitous Santa Clauses. Over 6,000 on display, the signs said. And he tugged urgently at the hem of her coat. Shadow followed Wednesday outside briefly, and then followed the signs to the streets of yesterday. 40 years ago, Alex Jordan, his face is on the token you have palmed in your right hand, Shadow, began to build a house on a high jut of rock in a field he did not own. And even he could not have told you why. And people came to see him build it, the curious and the puzzled and those who were neither and who could not honestly have told you why they came. So he did what any sensible American male of his generation would do. He began to charge them money. Nothing much, a nickel each, perhaps, or a quarter. And he continued building, and the people kept coming. So he took those quarters and nickels and made something even bigger and stranger. He built these warehouses on the ground beneath the house and filled them with things for people to see, and then the people came to see them. Millions of people come here every year. Why? But Wednesday simply smiled, and they walked into the dimly lit, tree-lined streets of yesterday. Prim-lipped Victorian china dolls stared in profusion through dusty store windows like so many props from respectable horror films. Cobblestones under their feet, the darkness of a roof above their heads, jangling mechanical music in the background. They passed a glass box of broken puppets and an overgrown golden music box in a glass case. They passed the dentist's and the drugstore. Restore potency. Use O'Leary's magnetical belt. At the end of the street was a large glass box with a female mannequin inside it, dressed as a gypsy fortune teller. Now, boomed Wednesday over the mechanical music. At the start of any quest or enterprise, it behooves us to consult the Norns, so let us designate this Sybil our Erd, eh? He dropped a brass-colored house on the rock coin into the slot. With jagged mechanical motions, the gypsy lifted her arm and lowered it once more, a slip of paper chunked out of the slot. Wednesday took it, read it, grunted, folded it up, and put it in his pocket. "Aren't you going to show it to me?" "I'll show you mine," said Shadow. "A man's fortune is his own affair," said Wednesday, stiffly. "I would not ask to see yours." Shadow put his own coin in the slot. He took his slip of paper. He read it. "Every ending is a new beginning. Your lucky number is none. Your lucky color is dead. Motto, like father, like son." Shadow made a face. He folded the fortune up and put it in his inside pocket. They went further in, down a red corridor, past rooms filled with empty chairs upon which rested violins and violas and cellos, which played themselves, or seemed to, when fed a coin. Keys depressed, cymbals crashed, pipes blew compressed air into clarinets and oboes. Shadow observed, with a wry amusement, that the bows of the stringed instruments, played by mechanical arms, never actually touched the strings, which were often loose or missing. He wondered whether all the sounds he heard were made by wind and percussion, or whether there were tapes as well. They had walked for what felt like several miles, when they came to a room called the Mikado, one wall of which was a 19th-century pseudo-Oriental nightmare in which beetle-browed mechanical drummers banged cymbals and drums while staring out from their dragon-encrusted lair. Currently they were majestically torturing Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre. Chernobog sat on a bench in the wall facing the Mikado machine, tapping out the time with his fingers. Pipes fluted, bells jangled. Wednesday sat next to him. Shadow decided to remain standing. Chernobog extended his left hand, shook Wednesday's, shook Shadow's. "Well met," he said. Then he sat back, apparently enjoying the music. The danse macabre came to a tempestuous and discordant end. That all the artificial instruments were ever so slightly out of tune added to the otherworldliness of the place. A new piece began.
"How was your bank robbery?" asked Chernobog. "It went well?" He
stood, reluctant to leave the Mikado and its thundering, jangling music.
"Slick as a snake in a barrel of butter," said Wednesday. "I get a pension from the slaughterhouse," said Chernobog. "I do not ask for more."
"It won't last forever," said Wednesday. "Nothing does." More corridors, more musical machines. Shadow became aware that they were not following the path through the rooms intended for tourists, but seemed to be following a different route of Wednesday's own devising. They were going down a slope, and Shadow, confused, wondered if they had already been that way. Chernobog grasped Shadow's arm.
"Quickly, come here,"
he said, pulling him over to a large glass box by a wall. It contained a diorama of a tramp asleep in a churchyard, in front of a church door. "The Drunkard's Dream," said the label, explaining that it was a 19th-century penny-in-the-slot machine, originally from an English railway station. The coin slot had been modified to take the brass house-on-the-rock coins.
"Put in the money," said Chernobog.
"Why?" asked Shadow.
"You must see, I assure you."
Shadow inserted his coin. The drunk in the graveyard raised his bottle to his lips. One of the gravestones flipped over, revealing a grasping corpse. A headstone turned around, flowers replaced by a grinning skull. A wraith appeared on the right of the church, while on the left of the church something with a half-glimpsed, pointed, unsettlingly bird-like face, a pale Boschian nightmare, glided smoothly from a headstone into the shadows and was gone. Then the church door opened, a priest came out, and the ghosts, haunts, and corpses vanished, and only the priest and the drunk were left alone in the graveyard. The priest looked down at the drunk disdainfully, and backed through the open door, which closed behind him, leaving the drunk on his own. The clockwork story was deeply unsettling. Much more unsettling, thought Shadow, than clockwork has any right to be.
"You know why I show that to you?" asked Chernobog.
"No."
"That is the world as it is. That is the real world. It is there, in that box."
They wandered through a blood-colored room, filled with old theatrical organs, huge organ pipes, and what appeared to be enormous copper brewing vats, liberated from a brewery. "Where are we going?" asked Shadow.
"The carousel," said Chernobog.
"But we've passed signs to the carousel a dozen times already."
"He goes his way. We travel a spiral. The quickest way is sometimes the longest."
Shadow's feet were beginning to hurt, and he found this sentiment to be extremely unlikely. A mechanical machine played Octopus's Garden in a room that went up for many stories, the center of which was filled entirely with a replica of a great black whale-like beast with a life-sized replica of a boat in its vast fiberglass mouth. They passed on from there to a travel hall, where they saw the car covered with tiles, and the functioning Rube Goldberg chicken device, and the rusting Burmeshave ads on the wall. "Life is hard. It's toil and trouble. Keep your jawline free from stubble. Burmeshave." Read one, and he undertook to overtake. The road was on a bend. From now on, the undertaker is his only friend. Burmeshave. And they were at the bottom of a ramp now, with an ice cream shop in front of them. It was nominally open, but the girl washing down the surfaces had a closed look on her face. So they walked past it into the pizzeria cafeteria, empty but for an elderly black man wearing a bright check suit and canary yellow gloves. He was a small man, the kind of little old man who looked as if the passing of the years had shrunk him. Eating an enormous, many-scooped ice cream sundae, drinking a supersized mug of coffee. A black cigarillo was burning in the ashtray in front of him. "Three coffees," said Wednesday to Shadow. He went to the restroom. Shadow bought the coffees and took them over to Chernobog, who was sitting with the old black man and was smoking a cigarette surreptitiously as if he were scared of being caught. The other man, happily toying with his sundae, mostly ignored his cigarillo, but as Shadow approached, he picked it up, inhaled deeply, and blew two smoke rings, first one large one, then another smaller one, which passed neatly through the first. And he grinned, as if he were astonishingly pleased with himself.
"Shadow, this is Mr. Nancy," said Chernobog.
The old man got to his feet and thrust out his yellow-gloved right hand. "Good to meet you," he said with a dazzling smile.
"I know who you must be. You're working for the old one-eyed bastard, aren't you?"
There was a faint twang in his voice, a hint of a patois that might have been West Indian. "I work for Mr. Wednesday," said Shadow. "Yes. Please, sit down." Chernobog inhaled on his cigarette.
"I think," he pronounced gloomily, "that our kind, we like the cigarettes so much because they remind us of the offerings that once they burned for us, the smoke rising up as they sought our approval or our favor."
"They never give me nothing like that," said Nancy. "Best I could hope for was a pile of fruit to eat, maybe curried goat, something slow and cold and tall to drink, and a big old high-titty woman to keep me company."
He grinned, white teeth, and winked at Shadow.
"These days," said Chernobog, his expression unchanged, "we have nothing."
"Well, I don't get anywhere near as much fruit as I used to," said Mr. Nancy, his eyes shining. "But there still ain't nothing out there in the world for my money that can beat a big old high-titty woman. Some folks you talk to, they say it's the booty you got to inspect at first, but I'm here to tell you that it's the titties that still crank my engine on a cold morning."
Nancy began to laugh, a wheezing, rattling, good-natured laugh, and Shadow found himself liking the old man despite himself. Wednesday returned from the restroom and shook hands with Nancy.
"Shadow, you want something to eat? Slice of pizza or a sandwich?"
"I'm not hungry," said Shadow.
"Let me tell you something," said Mr. Nancy. "It can be a long time between meals. Someone offers you food, you say yes. I'm no longer young as I was, but I can tell you this. You never say no to the opportunity to piss, to eat, or to get half an hour's shut-eye. You follow me?"
"Yes, but I'm really not hungry."
"You're a big one,"
said Nancy, staring into Shadow's light gray eyes with old eyes the color of mahogany.
"A tall drink of water. But I got to tell you, you don't look too bright. I got a son, stupid as a man who bought his stupid at a two-for-one sale. And you remind me of him."
"If you don't mind, I'll take that as a compliment," said Shadow.
"Being called dumb as a man who slept late the morning they handed out brains?"
"Being compared to a member of your family." Mr. Nancy stubbed out his cigarillo, then he flicked an imaginary speck of ash off his yellow gloves.
"You may not be the worst choice, old one, I could have made, come to that."
He looked up at Wednesday.
"You got any idea how many of us there's going to be here tonight?"
"I sent the message out to everyone I could find," said Wednesday. "Obviously, not everyone is going to be able to come, and some of them," with a pointed look at Chernobog, "might not want to. But I think we can confidently expect several dozen of us, and the word will travel."
They made their way past a display of suits of armor. "Victorian fake," pronounced Wednesday as they passed the glassed-in display.
"Modern fake. 12th-century helm on a 17th-century reproduction. 15th-century left gauntlet."
And then Wednesday pushed through an exit door, circled them around the outside of the building.
"I can't be doing with all these ins and outs," said Nancy. "I'm not as young as I used to be, and I come from warmer climes."
along a covered walkway, in through another exit door, and they were in the carousel room. Calliope music played, a Strauss waltz, stirring and occasionally discordant. The wall, as they entered, was hung with antique carousel horses, hundreds of them, some in need of a lick of paint, others in need of a good dusting. Above them hung dozens of winged angels constructed, rather obviously, from female store window mannequins. Some of them bared their sexless breasts, some had lost their wigs and stared baldly and blindly down from the darkness. And then there was the carousel. A sign proclaimed it was the largest in the world, said how much it weighed, how many thousand light bulbs were to be found in the chandeliers that hung from it in Gothic profusion, and forbade anyone from climbing on it or from riding on the animals. And such animals! Shadow stared, impressed in spite of himself, at the hundreds of full-sized creatures who circled on the platform of the carousel, real creatures, imaginary creatures, and transformations of the two. Each creature was different. He saw mermaid and merman, centaur and unicorn, elephants, one huge, one tiny, bulldog, frog and phoenix, zebra, tiger, manticore and basilisk, swans pulling a carriage, a white ox, a fox, twin walruses, even a sea serpent, all of them brightly colored and more than real. Each rode the platform as the waltz came to an end and a new waltz began. The carousel did not even slow down. "What's it for?" asked Shadow. "I mean, okay, world's biggest, hundreds of animals, thousands of light bulbs, and it goes around all the time, and no one ever rides it." "It's not there to be ridden, not by people," said Wednesday. "It's there to be admired. It's there to be." "Like a prayer wheel going round and round," said Mr. Nancy. "Accumulating power." "So, where are we meeting everyone?" asked Shadow. "I thought you said that we were meeting them here, but the place is empty." Wednesday grinned his scary grin. "Shadow," he said, "you're asking too many questions. You are not paid to ask questions." "Sorry." "Now, stand over here and help us up," said Wednesday, and he walked over to the platform on one side, with a description of the carousel on it, and a warning that the carousel was not to be ridden. Shadow thought of saying something, but instead he helped them, one by one, up onto the ledge. Wednesday seemed profoundly heavy. Chernobog climbed up himself, only using Shadow's shoulder to steady himself. Nancy seemed to weigh nothing at all. Each of the old men climbed out onto the ledge, and then, with a step and a hop, they walked out onto the circling carousel platform. "Well," barked Wednesday, "aren't you coming?" Shadow, not without a certain amount of hesitation and a hasty look around for any House on the Rock personnel who might be watching, swung himself up onto the ledge beside the world's largest carousel. Shadow was amused and a little puzzled to realize that he was far more concerned about breaking the rules by climbing onto the carousel than he had been aiding and abetting this afternoon's bank robbery. Each of the old men selected a mount. Wednesday climbed onto a golden wolf. Chernobog climbed onto an armored centaur, its face hidden by a metal helmet. Nancy, chuckling, slithered up onto the back of an enormous leaping lion captured by the sculptor mid-roar. He patted the side of the lion. The Strauss waltz carried them around, majestically. Wednesday was smiling, and Nancy was laughing delightedly, an old man's cackle, and even the doer Chernobog seemed to be enjoying himself. Shadow felt as if a weight were suddenly lifted from his back. Three old men were enjoying themselves, riding the world's biggest carousel. So what if they did get all thrown out of the place? Wasn't it worth it? Worth anything to say that you had ridden on the world's biggest carousel? Wasn't it worth it to have traveled on one of those glorious monsters? Shadow inspected a bulldog and a mer creature, and an elephant with a golden howdah, and then he climbed on the back of a creature with an eagle's head and the body of a tiger, and held on tight. The rhythm of the Blue Danube waltz rippled and rang and sang in his head. The lights of a thousand chandeliers glinted and prismed, and for a heartbeat Shadow was a child again. And all it took to make him happy was to ride the carousel. He stayed perfectly still, riding his eagle tiger at the center of everything, and the world revolved around him. Shadow heard himself laugh over the sound of the music. He was happy. It was as if the last 36 hours had never happened, as if the last 3 years had not happened, as if his life had evaporated into the daydream of a small child riding the carousel in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, on his first trip back to the States, a marathon journey by ship and by car, his mother standing there, watching him proudly, and himself sucking his melting popsicle, holding on tightly, hoping that the music would never stop, the carousel would never slow, the ride would never end. He was going around and around and around again. Then the lights went out, and Shadow saw the gods.
This ends Disc 4. American Gods, Disc 5.
Chapter 6. Wide open and unguarded stand our gates, and through them passes a wild motley throng. Men from Volga and Tartar steppes, featureless figures from the Huang Ho, Malayan, Scythian, Teuton, Celt, and Slav, flying the old world's poverty and scorn. These bringing with them unknown gods and rites, those tiger passions here to stretch their claws in street and alley. What strange tongues are these, accents of menace in our ear, voices that once the Tower of Babel knew. Thomas Bailey Aldrich, The Unguarded Gates, 1882. One moment Shadow was riding the world's largest carousel, holding onto his eagle-headed tiger, and then the red and white lights of the carousel stretched and shivered and went out, and he was falling through an ocean of stars, while the mechanical waltz was replaced by a pounding, rhythmic roll and crash as of cymbals or the breakers on the shores of a far ocean. The only light was starlight, but it illuminated everything with a cold clarity. Beneath him his mount stretched and padded, its warm fur under his left hand, its feathers beneath his right.
"It's a good ride, isn't it?"
the voice came from behind him, in his ears and in his mind. Shadow turned slowly, streaming images of himself as he moved, frozen moments, each him captured in a fraction of a second, every tiny movement lasting for an infinite period. The images that reached his mind made no sense. It was like seeing the world through the multifaceted, jeweled eyes of a dragonfly, but each facet saw something completely different, and he was unable to combine the things he was seeing, or thought he was seeing, into a whole that made any sense. He was looking at Mr. Nancy, an old black man with a pencil mustache, in his check sports jacket and his lemon-yellow gloves, riding a carousel lion as it rose and lowered high in the air, and at the same time, in the same place, he saw a jeweled spider as high as a horse, its eyes an emerald nebula, strutting, staring down at him, and simultaneously he was looking at an extraordinarily tall man with teak-colored skin and three sets of arms, wearing a flowing ostrich feather headdress, his face painted with red stripes, riding an irritated golden lion, two of his six hands holding on tightly to the beast's mane, and he was also seeing a young black boy dressed in rags, his left foot all swollen and crawling with black flies. And last of all, and behind all these things, Shadow was looking at a tiny brown spider, hiding under a withered ochre leaf. Shadow saw all these things, and he knew they were the same thing.
"If you don't close your mouth," said the many things that were Mr. Nancy, "something's going to fly in there."
Shadow closed his mouth and swallowed, hard. There was a wooden hall on a hill, a mile or so from them. They were trotting toward the hall, their mounts' hooves and feet padding noiselessly on the dry sand at the sea's edge. Chernobog trotted up on his centaur. He tapped the human arm of his mount.
"None of this is truly happening," he said to Shadow.
He sounded miserable.
"It's all in your head. Best not to think of it."
Shadow saw a gray-haired, old, Eastern European immigrant with a shabby raincoat and one iron-colored tooth. True, but he also saw a squat black thing, darker than the darkness that surrounded them, its eyes two burning coals. And he saw a prince, with long, flowing black hair and a long black mustache, blood on his hands and his face, riding, naked but for a bearskin over his shoulder, on a creature half man, half beast, his face and torso blue tattooed with swirls and spirals.
"Who are you?" asked Shadow. "What are you?"
Their mounts padded along the shore. Waves broke and crashed implacably on the night beach. Wednesday guided his wolf, now a huge and charcoal-gray beast with green eyes, over to Shadow. Shadow's mount caracoled away from it, and Shadow stroked its neck and told it not to be afraid. Its tiger tail swished aggressively. It occurred to Shadow that there was another wolf, a twin to the one that Wednesday was riding, keeping pace with them in the sand dunes, just a moment out of sight.
"Do you know me, Shadow?" said Wednesday.
He rode his wolf with his head high. His right eye glittered and flashed. His left eye was dull. He wore a cloak with a deep monk-like cowl, and his face stared out from the shadows.
"I told you I would tell you my names. This is what they call me. I am called Glad of War, Grim, Raider, and Third. I am One-Eyed. I am called Highest and True Guesser. I am Grimnir, and I am the Hooded One. I am All-Father, and I am Gundlir, Wand-Bearer. I have as many names as there are winds, as many titles as there are ways to die. My ravens are Hugin and Munin, Thought and Memory. My wolves are Freki and Geri. My horse is the Gallows."
Two ghostly gray ravens, like transparent skins of birds, landed on Wednesday's shoulders, pushed their beaks into the side of Wednesday's head, as if tasting his mind, and flapped out into the world once more. "What should I believe?" thought Shadow, and the voice came back to him from somewhere deep beneath the world in a bass rumble. "Believe everything." "Odin?" said Shadow, and the wind whipped the word from his lips.
"Odin,"
whispered Wednesday, and the crash of the breakers on the beach of skulls was not loud enough to drown that whisper.
"Odin," said Wednesday, tasting the sound of the words in his mouth. "Odin," said Wednesday, his voice a triumphant shout which echoed from horizon to horizon.
His name swelled and grew and filled the world like the pounding of blood in Shadow's ears. And then, as in a dream, they were no longer riding toward a distant hall. They were already there, and their mounts were tied in the shelter beside the hall. The hall was huge but primitive. The roof was thatched, the walls were wooden. There was a fire burning in the center of the hall, and the smoke stung Shadow's eyes.
"We should have done this in my mind, not in his," muttered Mr. Nancy to Shadow. "It would have been warmer there."
"We're in his mind?"
"More or less. This is Valashalf. It's his old hall."
Shadow was relieved to see that Nancy was now once more an old man wearing yellow gloves, although his shadow shook and shivered and changed in the flames of the fire, and what it changed into was not always entirely human. There were wooden benches against the walls, and sitting on them or standing beside them, perhaps 10 people. They kept their distance from each other. A mixed lot, who included a dark-skinned, matronly woman in a red sari, several shabby-looking businessmen, and others too close to the fire for Shadow to be able to make them out.
"Where are they?"
whispered Wednesday fiercely to Nancy.
"Well, where are they? There should be scores of us here, dozens."
"You did all the inviting," said Nancy. "I think it's a wonder you got as many here as you did. You think I should tell a story to start things off?"
Wednesday shook his head. "Out of the question."
"They don't look very friendly," said Nancy. "A story's a good way of getting someone on your side, and you don't have a bar to sing to them."
"No stories," said Wednesday. "Not now. Later there'll be time for stories, not now."
"No stories, right? I'll just be the warm-up man."
And Mr. Nancy strode out into the firelight with an easy smile.
"I know what you are all thinking," he said. "You are thinking, what is Compey Anansi doing, coming out to talk to you all, when the old father called you all here, just like he called me here? Well, you know, sometimes people need reminding of things. I look around when I come in, and I thought, where's the rest of us? But then I thought, just because we are few and they are many, we are weak and they are powerful, it does not mean that we are lost. You know, one time I saw Tiger down at the water hole. He had the biggest testicles of any animal, and the sharpest claws, and two front teeth as long as knives and as sharp as blades. And I said to him, 'Brother Tiger, you go for a swim. I look after your balls for you.' He was so proud of his balls. So he got into the water hole for a swim, and I put his balls on, and left him with my own little spider balls. And then you know what I did? I ran away. Fast as my legs would take me. I didn't stop till I got to the next town, and I saw old Monkey there. 'You looking mighty fine, Anansi,' said old Monkey. I said to him, 'You know what they're all singing in the town over there?' 'What are they singing?' he asked me. 'They singing the funniest song,' I told him. Then I did a dance, and I sings, 'Tiger's balls, yeah. I ate tiger's balls. Now ain't nobody gonna stop me ever at all. Nobody put me up against the big black wall, 'cause I ate that tiger's testimonials. I ate tiger's balls.' Old Monkey, he laughs fit to bust, holding his side and shaking and stamping. Then he starts singing, 'Tiger's balls, I ate tiger's balls,' snapping his fingers, spinning around on his 2 feet. 'That's a fine song,' he says. 'I'm going to sing it to all my friends.' 'You do that,' I tell him. And I head back to the watering hole. There's Tiger, down by the water hole, walking up and down, with his tail switching and swishing, and his ears and the fur on his neck up as far as they can go, and he's snapping at every insect comes by with his huge old saber teeth, and his eyes flashing orange fire. He looks mean and scary and big, but dangling between his legs, there's the littlest balls in the littlest, blackest, most wrinkledy ball sack you ever did see. 'Hey, Anansi,' he says, when he sees me, 'you were supposed to be guarding my balls while I went swimming. But when I got out of the swimming hole, there was nothing on the side of the bank but these little black, shriveled-up, good-for-nothing spider balls I'm wearing. I'd done my best,' I tells him. 'But it was those monkeys. They come by and eat your balls all up. And when I tell them off, then they pulled off my own little balls, and I was so ashamed I ran away.' 'You a liar, Anansi,' says Tiger. 'I'm going to eat your liver.' But then he hears the monkeys coming from their town to the waterhole, a dozen happy monkeys bopping down the path, clicking their fingers and singing as loud as they could sing, 'Tiger's balls, yeah. I eat tiger's balls. Now ain't nobody gonna stop me ever at all. Nobody put me up against the big black wall, 'cause I ate that tiger's testimonials. I ate tiger's balls.' And Tiger, he growls and he roars, and he's off into the forest after them, and the monkeys screech and head for the highest trees. And I scratch my nice, new, big balls, and damn, they felt good hanging between my skinny legs. Then I walk on home. And even today, Tiger keeps chasing monkeys. So you all remember, just because you're small, doesn't mean you got no power."
Mr. Nancy smiled, and bowed his head, and spread his hands, accepting the applause and laughter like a pro. And then he turned and walked back to where Shadow and Chernobog were standing. "I thought I said no stories," said Wednesday.
"You call that a story?" said Nancy. "I barely cleared my throat. Just warmed them up for you. Go knock them dead."
Wednesday walked out into the firelight, a big old man with a glass eye in a brown suit and an old Armani coat. He stood there, looking at the people on the wooden benches, saying nothing for longer than Shadow could believe someone could comfortably say nothing. And finally he spoke. "You know me," he said. "You all know me. Some of you have no cause to love me, but love me or not, you know me." There was a rustling, a stir among the people on the benches. "I've been here longer than most of you. Like the rest of you, I figured we could get by on what we got. Not enough to make us happy, but enough to keep going. That may not be the case anymore. There's a storm coming, and it's not a storm of our making." He paused. Now he stepped forward and folded his arms across his chest. "When the people came to America, they brought us with them. They brought me and Loki and Thor and Anansi and the Lion God, Leprechauns and Kurakans and Banshees, Kubera and Frau Holla and Ashtaroth. And they brought you. We rode here in their mines, and we took root. We traveled with the settlers to the new lands across the ocean. The land is vast. Soon enough our people abandoned us, remembered us only as creatures of the old land, as things that had not come with them to the new. Our true believers passed on, or stopped believing. And we were left, lost and scared and dispossessed. Only what little smidgens of worship or belief we could find. And to get by as best we could. So that's what we've done, gotten by. Out on the edges of things, where no one was watching us too closely. We have, let us face it, and admit it, little influence. We prey on them, and we take from them, and we get by. We strip, and we whore, and we drink too much. We pump gas, and we steal, and we cheat, and we exist in the cracks at the edges of society. Old gods, here in this new land, without gods." Wednesday paused. He looked from one to another of his listeners, grave and statesmanlike. They stared back at him impassively, their faces mask-like and unreadable. Wednesday cleared his throat and he spat hard into the fire. It flared and flamed, illuminating the inside of the hall. "Now, as all of you will have had reason aplenty to discover for yourselves, there are new gods growing in America, clinging to growing knots of belief, gods of credit card and freeway, of internet and telephone, of radio and hospital and television, gods of plastic, and of beeper, and of neon. Proud gods, fat and foolish creatures, puffed up with their own newness and importance. They are aware of us, and they fear us, and they hate us," said Odin. "You are fooling yourselves if you believe otherwise. They will destroy us if they can. It is time for us to band together. It is time for us to act." The old woman in the red sari stepped into the firelight. On her forehead was a small, dark blue jewel. She said, "You called us here for this nonsense?" And then she snorted, a snort of mingled amusement and irritation. Wednesday's brows lowered. "I called you here, yes. But this is sense, Mamaji, not nonsense. Even a child could see that." "So I am a child, am I?" She wagged a finger at him. "I was old in Kalegat before you were dreamed of, you foolish man. I am a child? Then I am a child, for there is nothing in your foolish talk to see." Again a moment of double vision. Shadow saw the old woman, her dark face pinched with age and disapproval, but behind her he saw something huge, a naked woman with skin as black as a new leather jacket, and lips and tongue the bright red of arterial blood. Around her neck were skulls, and her many hands held knives and swords and severed heads. "I did not call you a child, Mamaji," said Wednesday peaceably, "but it seems self-evident, the only thing that seems self-evident," said the old woman, pointing, as behind her, through her, above her, a black finger, sharp-taloned, pointed in echo, "is your own desire for glory.
We've lived in peace in this country for a long time. Some of us do better than others, I agree. I do well. Back in India, there is an incarnation of me who does much better, but so be it. I am not envious. I've watched the new ones rise, and I've watched them fall again.
Her hand fell to her side. Shadow saw that the others were looking at her, a mixture of expressions, respect, amusement, embarrassment in their eyes.
They worshipped the railroads here, only a blink of an eye ago. And now the iron gods are as forgotten as the emerald hunters.
Make your point, Mama G, said Wednesday.
My point?
Her nostrils flared, the corners of her mouth turned down.
I am obviously only a child, say that we wait. We do nothing. We don't know that they mean us harm.
And will you still counsel waiting when they come in the night and they kill you or they take you away?
Her expression was disdainful and amused. It was all in the lips and the eyebrows and the set of the nose.
If they try such a thing, she said, they will find me hard to catch and harder still to kill.
A squat young man sitting on the bench behind her harumphed for attention, then said with a booming voice,
All-Father, my people are comfortable. We make the best of what we have. If this war of yours goes against us, we could lose everything.
Wednesday said, You have already lost everything. I'm offering you the chance to take something back. The fire blazed high as he spoke, illuminating the faces of the audience. I don't really believe, Shadow thought. I don't believe any of this. Maybe I'm still 15. Mom's still alive, and I haven't even met Laura yet. Everything that's happened so far has been some kind of especially vivid dream. And yet he could not believe that either. All we have to believe with is our senses, the tools we use to perceive the world, our sight, our touch, our memory. If they lie to us, then nothing can be trusted. And even if we do not believe, then still we cannot travel in any other way than the road our senses show us. And we must walk that road to the end. Then the fire burned out, and there was darkness in Valashov, Odin's hall.
Now what?
Whispered Shadow.
Now we go back to the carousel room, muttered Mr. Nancy, and old One-Eye buys us all dinner, greases some palms, kisses some babies, and no one says the G-word anymore.
G-word?
Gods! What were you doing the day they handed out brains, boy, anyway?
Someone was telling a story about stealing a tiger's balls, and I had to stop and find out how it ended. Mr. Nancy chuckled. But nothing was resolved. Nobody agreed to anything.
He's working them slowly. He'll land them one at a time, you'll see. They'll come around in the end.
Shadow could feel that a wind was coming up from somewhere, stirring his hair, touching his face, pulling at him. They were standing in the room of the biggest carousel in the world, listening to the Emperor waltz. There was a group of people, tourists by the look of them, talking with Wednesday over at the other side of the room, as many people as there had been shadowy figures in Wednesday's hall.
"Through here,"
boomed Wednesday, and he led them through the only exit, formed to look like the gaping mouth of a huge monster, its sharp teeth ready to rend them all to slivers. He moved among them like a politician, cajoling, encouraging, smiling, gently disagreeing, pacifying.
"Did that happen?"
asked Shadow.
"Did what happen, shit for brains?"
asked Mr. Nancy. "The hall, the fire, tiger balls, riding the carousel."
"Heck, nobody's allowed to ride the carousel. Didn't you see the signs? Now hush."
The monster's mouth led to the organ room, which puzzled Shadow. Hadn't they already come through that way? It was no less strange the second time. Wednesday led them all up some stairs, past life-sized models of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse hanging from the ceiling, and they followed the signs to an early exit. Shadow and Nancy brought up the rear, and then they were out of the house on the rock, walking past the gift store and heading back into the parking lot.
"Pity we had to leave before the end," said Mr. Nancy. "I was kind of hoping to see the biggest artificial orchestra in the whole world."
"I've seen it," said Chernobog. "It's not so much."
The restaurant was 10 minutes up the road. Wednesday had told each of his guests that tonight's dinner was on him and had organized rides to the restaurant for any of them that didn't have their own transportation. Shadow wondered how they had gotten to the house on the rock in the first place, without their own transportation, and how they were going to get away again. But he said nothing. It seemed the smartest thing to say. Shadow had a car full of Wednesday's guests to ferry to the restaurant. The woman in the red sari sat in the front seat beside him. There were two men in the back seat. The squat, peculiar-looking young man, whose name Shadow had not properly caught, but which sounded like Elvis, and another man in a dark suit whose Shadow could not remember. He had stood beside the man as he got into the car, had opened and closed the door for him, and was unable to remember anything about him. He turned around in the driver's seat and looked at him, carefully noting his face, his hair, his clothes, making certain he would know him if he met him again, and turned back to start the car to find that the man had slipped from his mind. An impression of wealth was left behind, but nothing more. "I'm tired," thought Shadow. He glanced to his right and snuck a glance at the Indian woman. He noted the tiny silver necklace of skulls that circled her neck, her charm bracelet of heads and hands that jangled like tiny bells when she moved, the dark blue jewel on her forehead. She smelled of spices, of cardamom and nutmeg and flowers. Her hair was pepper and salt, and she smiled when she saw him look at her.
"You call me Mama G," she said.
"I am Shadow, Mama G," said Shadow.
"And what do you think of your employer's plans, Mr. Shadow?"
He slowed as a large black truck sped past, overtaking them with a spray of slush.
"I don't ask, he don't tell," he said.
"If you ask me, he wants a last stand. He wants us to go out in a blaze of glory. That's what he wants, and we are old enough or stupid enough that maybe some of us will say yes."
"It's not my job to ask questions, Mama G," said Shadow.
The inside of the car filled with her tinkling laughter. The man in the back seat, not the peculiar-looking young man, the other one, said something, and Shadow replied to him, but a moment later he was damned if he could remember what had been said. The peculiar-looking young man had said nothing, but now he started to hum to himself, a deep, melodic bass humming that made the interior of the car vibrate and rattle and buzz. The peculiar-looking man was of average height, but of an odd shape. Shadow had heard of men who were barrel-chested before, but had no image to accompany the metaphor. This man was barrel-chested, and he had legs like tree trunks, and hands like, exactly, ham hocks. He wore a black parka with a hood, several sweaters, thick dungarees, and incongruously, in the winter and with those clothes, a pair of white tennis shoes, which were the same size and shape as shoe boxes. His fingers resembled sausages with flat, squared-off fingertips.
"That's some hum you got," said Shadow from the driver's seat.
"Sorry,"
said the peculiar young man in a deep, deep voice, embarrassed. He stopped humming.
"No, I enjoyed it," said Shadow. "Don't stop."
The peculiar young man hesitated, then commenced to hum once more, his voice as deep and reverberant as before. This time there were words interspersed in the humming.
"Down, down, down,"
he sang so deeply that the windows rattled.
"Down, down, 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 down."
Christmas lights were draped across the eaves of every house and building that they drove past.
They ranged from discreet golden lights that dripped twinkles to giant displays of snowmen and teddy bears and multicolored stars. Shadow pulled up at the restaurant, a big barn-like structure, and he let his passengers off by the front door. He drove the car to the back of the parking lot. He wanted to make the short walk back to the restaurant alone, in the cold, to clear his head. He parked the car beside a black truck. He wondered if it was the same one that had sped past him earlier. He closed the car door and stood there in the parking lot, his breath steaming. Inside the restaurant, Shadow could imagine Wednesday already sitting all his guests down around a big table, working the room. Shadow wondered whether he had really had Kali in the front of his car. Wondered what he'd been driving in the back. "Hey, bud, you got a match?" said a voice that was half familiar, and Shadow turned to apologize and say no. He didn't, but the gun barrel hit him over the left eye, and he started to fall. He put out an arm to steady himself as he went down. Someone pushed something soft into his mouth to stop him crying out and taped it into position. Easy, practiced moves, like a butcher gutting a chicken. Shadow tried to shout, to warn Wednesday, to warn them all, but nothing came out of his mouth but a muffled noise. "The quarry are all inside," said the half-familiar voice. "Everyone in position?" A crackle of a voice, half-audible through a radio. "Let's move in and round them all up." "What about the big guy?" said another voice. "Package him up, take him out," said the first voice. They put a bag-like hood over Shadow's head and bound his wrists and ankles with tape and put him in the back of a truck and drove him away. There were no windows in the tiny room in which they had locked Shadow. There was a plastic chair, a lightweight folding table, and a bucket with a cover on it, which served Shadow as a makeshift toilet. There was also a 6-foot-long strip of yellow foam on the floor and a thin blanket with a long-since-crusted brown stain in the center. Blood. Or shit. Or food. Shadow didn't know, and didn't care to investigate. There was a naked bulb behind a metal grill high in the room, but no light switch that Shadow had been able to find. The light was always on. There was no door handle on his side of the door. He was hungry. The first thing he had done, when the spooks had pushed him into the room after they'd ripped off the tape from his ankles and wrists and mouth and left him alone, was to walk around the room and inspect it carefully. He tapped the walls. They sounded dully metallic. There was a small ventilation grid at the top of the room. The door was soundly locked. He was bleeding above the left eyebrow in a slow ooze. His head ached. The floor was uncarpeted. He tapped it. It was made of the same metal as the walls. He took the top off the bucket, pissed in it, and covered it once more. According to his watch, only 4 hours had passed since the raid on the restaurant. His wallet was gone, but they had left him his coins. He sat on the chair at the card table. The table was covered with a cigarette-burned green baize. Shadow practiced appearing to push coins through the table. Then he took 2 quarters and made up a pointless coin trick. He concealed a quarter in his right palm and openly displayed the other quarter in his left hand, between finger and thumb. Then he appeared to take the quarter from his left hand while actually letting it drop back into his left hand. He opened his right hand to display the quarter that had been there all along. The thing about coin manipulation was that it took all Shadow's head to do it. Or rather, he couldn't do it if he was angry or upset. So the action of practicing an illusion, even one with, on its own, no possible use, for he had expended an enormous amount of effort and skill to make it appear that he had moved a quarter from one hand to the other, something that it takes no skill whatever to do for real, calmed him, cleared his mind of turmoil and fear. He began a trick even more pointless, a one-handed half-dollar to penny transformation, but with his 2 quarters. Each of the coins was alternately concealed and revealed as the trick progressed. He began with 1 quarter visible, the other hidden. He raised his hand to his mouth and blew on the visible coin while slipping it into a classic palm as the first 2 fingers took the hidden quarter out and presented it.
The effect was that he displayed a quarter in his hand, raised it to his mouth, blew on it, and lowered it again, displaying the same quarter all the while. He did it over and over and over again. He wondered if they were going to kill him. Then his hand trembled just a little, and one of the quarters dropped from his fingertip onto the stained green baize of the card table. And then, because he just couldn't do it anymore, he put the coins away and took out the Liberty Head dollar that Zorya Polunochnaya had given him and held on to it tightly and waited. At 3 in the morning, by his watch, the spooks returned to interrogate him. 2 men in dark suits, with dark hair and shiny black shoes. Spooks. One was square-jawed, wide-shouldered, had great hair, looked like he played football in high school, badly bitten fingernails. The other had a receding hairline, silver-rimmed round glasses, manicured nails. While they looked nothing alike, Shadow found himself suspecting that on some level, possibly cellular, the 2 men were identical. They stood on each side of the card table looking down at him. "How long have you been working for cargo, sir?" asked one. "I don't know what that is," said Shadow. "He calls himself Wednesday, Grim, old father, old guy. You've been seen with him, sir." "I've been working for him for a couple of days." "Don't lie to us, sir," said the spook with the glasses. "Okay," said Shadow, "I won't. But it's still a couple of days." The clean-jawed spook reached down and twisted Shadow's ear between finger and thumb. He squeezed as he twisted. The pain was intense. "We told you not to lie to us, sir," he said mildly. Then he let go. Each of the spooks had a gun bulge under his jacket. Shadow didn't try to retaliate. He pretended he was back in prison. "Do your own time," thought Shadow. "Don't tell them anything they don't know already. Don't ask questions." "These are dangerous people you're palling around with, sir," said the spook with glasses. "You'll be doing your country a service by turning state's evidence." He smiled sympathetically. "I'm the good cop," said the smile. "I see," said Shadow. "And if you don't want to help us, sir," said the clean-jawed spook, "you can see what we're like when we're not happy." He hit Shadow, an open-handed blow across the stomach, knocking the breath from him. It wasn't torture, Shadow thought, just punctuation. "I'm the bad cop," he retched. "I would like to make you happy," said Shadow, as soon as he could speak. "All we ask is your cooperation, sir." "Can I ask?" gasped Shadow. "Don't ask questions," he thought, but it was too late. The words were already spoken. "Can I ask who I'll be cooperating with?" "You want us to tell you our names?" asked the clean-jawed spook. "You have to be out of your mind." "No, he's got a point," said the spook with glasses. "It may make it easier for him to relate to us." He looked at Shadow and smiled like a man advertising toothpaste. "Hi, I'm Mr. Stone, sir. My colleague is Mr. Wood." "Actually," said Shadow, "I meant, what agency are you with? CIA? FBI?" Stone shook his head. "Gee, it's not as easy as that anymore, sir. Things just aren't that simple." "The private sector," said Wood. "The public sector, you know, there's a lot of interplay these days." "But I can assure you," said Stone, with another smiley smile, "we are the good guys. Are you hungry, sir?" He reached into a pocket of his jacket, pulled out a Snickers bar. "Here, a gift." "Thanks," said Shadow. He unwrapped the Snickers bar and ate it. "I guess you'd like something to drink with that. Coffee? Beer?" "Water, please," said Shadow. Stone walked to the door, knocked on it. He said something to the guard on the other side of the door, who nodded and returned a minute later with a polystyrene cup filled with cold water. "CIA," said Wood. He shook his head ruefully. "Those bozos. Hey, Stone, I heard a new CIA joke. Okay, how can we be sure the CIA wasn't involved in the Kennedy assassination?"
"I don't know," said Stone. "How can we be sure?"
"He's dead, isn't he?" said Wood.
They both laughed. "Feeling better now, sir?" asked Stone.
"I guess."
"So why don't you tell us what happened this evening, sir?"
We did some tourist stuff. Went to the house on the rock. Went out for some food. You know the rest. Stone sighed heavily.